where you have the wall and the constant reminder of what it means to live on the other side, with 100,000 policemen trying to keep you in, you know, with dogs and tanks and searchlights and that sort of thing. That is the issue. This is why I put it that particular way.
Kelly, you will be next, but I want to write down the names. I have Radicky and Paul. And who is the...
Paul.
What's my name? Your name, please.
Maxwell.
Say it again.
Maxwell.
We'll get the rest of you in a moment. Kelly? All right.
You hear him?
Yes.
You, everybody hear him?
Go ahead.
You only mentioned one, seemingly one facet of protection, and that was making advances towards the threatener. And I wonder, aren't we forgetting here what seems to be a more Christian principle in that you substitute yourself for the threatened person to protect him, rather than you yourself becoming an attacker of the original
attack? Well, two things. I wouldn't consider that a more Christian principle under the circumstances described. I have the job, first of all, of defending my family and not worrying about my own life. And secondly, when applied to nations, I think here would be a case where you'd have to ask yourself, now, are we operating under the principle of law or gospel? And one of the points I was trying to make is that nations are not run by gospel.
Well, then can a Christian live as a Christian in society if we are to be, it seems to me the idea of a Christian is to be a gospel person.
But he's also a creature of God, you see. He's also a citizen. And these two are separate operations. This is Luther's kingdom of power and kingdom of grace. Now surely, in warfare, I live as a Christian, and I've gone through two of them, remembering the commandment, thou shalt not kill, but also remembering that our Lord interpreted it for us, that the violation of this commandment is hatred, malice aforethought.
Isn't that what war is all about, hatred?
No.
I mean, maybe not in theory, but when it comes down to practice.
No, I'm here to say that this is not always the case, that the Christian has the responsibility not to hate, and this is possible.
Do you mean to say that Americans didn't hate Japanese in World War II?
Some of them did not, and I'm one of them.
Yeah, I mean, I'm from California, and I know that many Japanese American citizens were put in concentration camps sanctioned by Christian people.
Right. I'm glad that you admit California has some problems. I recognize that. And the last thing I would want to be saying up here is that our hands are clean. In no human situation in the human environment do you ever get to a problem with clean hands. And you've got the trick of deciding which is less grave than some other course of action. Okay.
Mr. Radicky.
Yeah.
I would certainly advocate it, but I'll leave it up to Dr. Charles.
Well, the substance of it is in print. I don't have all of the illustrations.
is that act of yours, law or gospel? Radicky, are you finished?
Yeah.
All right. Paul?
Yes, you mentioned that the problem seems to be in Southeast Asia that we are fighting against the forces opposing freedom. Therefore, the question is, why do we fight it in one area and try for peaceful coexistence in another? Why not annihilate it totally?
Well, for a number of reasons. Number one, we don't have the power to do it, and that's a very realistic approach, I think. It's the same question that developed at the time of Hungary, in 56. The Hungarians thought we ought to help. The fact is, we were not in the position to do so because we were occupied with the Israeli and the French and the English at the Suez Canal. Any nation is limited in its power. And in the interest, at the moment, of a closer relationship between us and the USSR on the possibility that this would help, develable conflict between China and the USSR, we kind of worked that angle of the problem. Of course it's cynical, in a sense, but this is the way power works in the world, in a multi-state system. Now, if we ever got beyond that, as some people advocate, and I agree in theory, then this might not be the case. The trouble with talking about world government and regional clusters is, how do you get from the multi-state system to that kind of arrangement? And nobody really can provide the answer for that. Coming back to your basic question. We're working at coexistence to some extent with the Soviet Union because it is such a mighty nuclear power. And they know, our leaders know, if this thing ever got started, probably all of civilization would be destroyed and nobody would gain anything. So our approach has been, well, let's try to understand each other a little better. Not that this is going to work very much. Where Vietnam is concerned and the Mediterranean, we have other approaches.
Who was the man we gave the floor before Vance? So I guess it was you, Lloyd.
I concede from the point that there is such a thing as a just war. Each and every one of us as Christians are still left with the decision of whether a war is moral or not. Now, you have come to the moral decision that we are under the threat of tyranny in Vietnam. How do we as individual Christians cut through all of the terminology of domino theories and military strategy and so forth to come to a conclusion that we are, say, under the threat of tyranny in Vietnam right now?
Well, this is a very good question. And of course one that confronts all of us. How do you make up your mind? What sources of information are available? Well, there are a good many sources of information available. I'm thinking of the 10 hours, for instance, that Dean Rusk spent under the Klieg lights trying to answer Fulbright and trying not to surrender executive authority to the Senate. There was a lot of information there. Foreign Affairs Journal, for instance, the article in April 66 by George Carver, which is one of the most sensible, objective description of how we got into Vietnam with all of the emotional stuff left out. And listening, reading closely, and in this particular case, always remembering what happens when people devoted to Marxism get control. They're destroyed. And Tibet would be a very large-scale example of what happens. Czechoslovakia. See, this is by design. We don't say from our side we're going to conquer the world. But the communists say this without batting an eye. This is the Marxist philosophy. And that has to be kept in mind. And for us theologians now, just to carry this one step further, we better look into the theology of this movement, analyze it theologically, and especially know the difference between ideology and theology. Some years ago, I did the theology of Marxism in the Concordia Theological Monthly. I think it's spelled out very simply there. You might want to look at that.
Before I give Vanslow the floor, I'd like to get the man's name way back there on the bleachers who, like this. And was there anyone? Okay. Thank you. All right, Mr. Evangelo.
I'm afraid I have a basic disagreement with this is a personal thing, and I don't want to fight it on anyone else. But as far as war is concerned, and my Christian conscience, whether you wish to call me an idiot or a violent person or a loser, I don't know whether the confessional stands on the war is doctrine or whether it's opinion. But I cannot, in all good conscience, take the life of another man, be it on the streets of a city, or be it in a war. But, of course, now we can discuss this. But the thing I am really wondering about is the references that you made in your address as to we, something about we create a new order or a world order. Well, this is the thing I'm about. Where do we get the right to create a world order? I don't know if it's something that Kevin showed us on, but Senator, former Senator Wayne Morrison. And he basically, well, the reason we are in Vietnam is because of our 1954 military containment policy concerning Southeast Asia. And as far as the way I look at the military containment policy, is that we will oppose any government which claims to be leftist, and we will support any government which claims to be anti-leftist. Whether they are representative of the people or not. And just for one example, I point to the chairman in Vietnam. How do we take our own system of democracy, of peace, well, I won't say peace, but of democracy, and enforce it on the rest of the world? How can we do this in good conscience as a nation?
Well, let me start with that last point. You know, this is one of the good things we have on our side. You don't really need to enforce our way of life. There are millions of people who would like nothing more than to have our way of life. And I've traveled around the world enough to realize to what degree that dream exists. I would therefore personally take exception to the word enforce. We just don't operate that way and haven't. In our history. We've got lots of history to document this with. Now, your point about Zien. This man gets much maligned. Actually, Zien was a very outstanding, good prime minister of South Vietnam until the agitation began from the north. And being a young country, he felt it necessary to repress. And this is where Kennedy made one of three major blunders. Get rid of Jim. If you ask me what the other two are, I'll tell you later on. No, we're not against all anti-left governments. What we are interested in is stability, security, development. And the last thing the United States is interested in is to create a world order after its own image. That's the meaning of the word development. We want people to develop their own values, their own cultures, within a world that is secure and stable. I cannot argue with your problem in conscience. That's your business, and I would be the last to want to try to change your mind, provided you have thought through all the angles of this, including the role of the military in national life, the nature of foreign policy, the multi-state system, and all that kind of thing, which I assume you have done. Thank God there are some conscientious objectors, because they inject a certain ethical set of values into our life, which we need. That's why James Madison, when he drew up the Bill of Rights, wanted to include one article on the right of the conscientious objector. This has been with us all the time, you see.
Mr. Bradley.
Yeah.
Rick. Professor Stout, you'll be next.
With regard to the amendment on the validity of the unjust war, plan to take the hand and amend each one of those items with regard specifically to the war in Vietnam and the quarrel with the citation of World War II as a just war. But I'm in doubt very much that you can justify, as our country is trying to, the application of the just war to Vietnam to prevent the first part legitimate authority. As has just been pointed out, the problem with the empty regime in Vietnam, and now the problem with the regime which is not allowing people who support the state take part in their own government, they're putting them in jail instead. Now, how does that constitute a legitimate authority that we should make support?
You want me to go through the seven points? I'll be very glad to do this. Be very glad to go through all the seven points and make the specific application. See, the point is that our nation is operating under legitimate authority in engaging in the conflict in Vietnam. What is the authority? Article 2 of the Constitution, which gives the president this right. Presidents have exercised it at least 125 times before in our history. It happens to be part of his job in foreign policy. As far as international authority is concerned, we're doing this under the protocol procedure of the CETO treaty. And by that protocol action, we included the principles of CETO, that is, we in Australia and a few others, and applied it to South Vietnam and to Laos and Thailand. Is there a moral purpose involved? That's the second one. I think I spent most of my time trying to exhibit that this is a very moral purpose, that the nature of freedom and the nature of man is at issue, and that's basically a moral stake. May I just finish the seven points? The question of excessive violence. Now, we go out of our way to try to avoid excessive violence. We have limited warfare. We tell people to get out of villages when, for some reason or other, it becomes necessary to destroy the buildings. What will be the subsequent conditions? Well, they will be much better than if we had never gone to war, because all of Southeast Asia, and I believe in the domino theory, as well as the Russians, they've got a head on them, all of Southeast Asia would come under the control of communist regimes, and I can't think of a fate much worse than that. Have all other means been exhausted? This is a little difficult to determine and can be debated, whether we really exhausted all possibilities before we went in. Is there selective immunity? Yes, I've already indicated that. We try to preserve the immunity of civilians to the degree that this is possible. And we are engaged in the restoration of moral order. As a matter of fact, we've always said our purpose is to get North Vietnam into a family of nations which follows moral principles. Okay, now your turn. That was a long speech.
People in South Vietnam and people in North Vietnam maybe don't see it quite the same way, because, for example, the point on what are going to be the conditions after the war? War is a very business anyway, and you can't fight a war without defoliating the country to some extent. But, what kind of country are we leaving? Secondly, Ho Chi Minh made a very strong effort to not allow his government to be controlled predominantly either by the Chinese or the Russian government, because he thought his necessity, his battle was one of unification of the whole country of Vietnam, not particularly struggling in terms of communism. Therefore, it seemed in his eyes, and I tend to think this is a much more correct position than ours, seen as a civil war and not as a struggle for world domination. I would have to reject the domino theory.
Well,
because there are many young people who do.
Well, without adequate acknowledgement sometimes of the facts involved. As a matter of fact, North Vietnam has 40,000 troops in Laos right now. Why?
Because
they believe this principle. They know that it happens.
They would not be allowed to sit on that airport with you.
Oh, don't kid yourself. Don't kid yourself. Now, let me get back to some of your points. What kind of country will we leave? Have you been in Germany recently? We left it in shambles in World War II and rebuilt it. That happens to be our policy. Have you been in South Korea lately? We have rebuilt and made a viable nation where there was nothing but destruction and chaos. That's what we're going to do. In fact, we're already doing it. Rebuilding, creating a better way of life, showing them how to run schools and this kind of thing. Now, see, you had one other point toward the beginning.
Well, I don't know. I guess the real question is that
I remember now. You had something about Ho Chi Minh.
That he
refused the Chinese and the Russians. Wasn't that your point? Well, let me look at it from the South Vietnamese point of view for a moment, because that's where we are. You know, when Ho Chi Minh took over North Vietnam, and this isn't said too often, he had to exterminate 250,000 people, which is not a very pleasant prospect, and that's why a million of them fled. I don't know whether the name Tom Dooley means anything. Tom Dooley was the man who brought 15th century medicine to 11th century Laos, as he put it. He was a naval officer in 54 when the million people were being transported from North Vietnam to South Vietnam by our ships. We had an agreement with North Vietnam that the Haiphong Harbor would be a sanctuary. This agreement was to last until May 15. On May 5, it was broken by Ho Chi Minh's government. And they brought in troops to pick up young people and made them say the Lord's Prayer. And when they got to the petition, "Give us this day our daily bread," they were accused of treason. They said, "God doesn't give daily bread. There is no God. We provide daily bread. Deliver us from evil is treason, because there is no evil in our system." And just to make the point stick, they took chopsticks and punched the eardrums of these young girls and boys, and in some cases slit their tongues so that they would never be able to hear treason and speak it. Now, this is the kind of government we're dealing with, I'd like to have you know. This is a very strange inversion of values, that Ho Chi Minh gets built up through public relations into being a great man. There was never a bigger thug, murderer, adulterer than Ho Chi Minh. But it exhibits the effectiveness with which the Communist Party throughout the world conducts its public relations. They can build up a scoundrel to make him look like George Washington, alas. Well, I thought I'd just introduce a few realistic items.
Bradley, are you going to continue? We'll ask Professor Stahlke.
It's a very simple question in a way. With conflict growing, possibly, between China and Russia, should we support Russia or should we support China?
I'm glad I'm not the Secretary of State. Or the president, for that matter, they have to decide that. Now, my feeling would be, on the basis of history, that if there is any side taking, we would be on the side of the Soviet Union against China. But that's a guess. I don't think there is going to be a great degree of hostilities between the two, really, for a while.
Shall I?
My question's been answered.
Is Nicholas? Over here, then, please.
You say that
speak loudly.
If we didn't build
within a world government, there would be, and necessarily has to be, a certain amount of uniformity in most aspects of life. And I wonder how, you know, you can bring to harmony this uniformity with your phrase of diversity that you had under freedom. I mean, it seems as though a world government would bring uniformity, and yet you say freedom is the right for diversity.
Yes, much would depend on how this world government is formed and how it operated. As a matter of fact, I think a very good case could be made out that the greatest of all evils might be a world government where you had no recourse and appeal to anything except the system itself. Now, under our policy, we counterpoise certain developments with others through the diversity. Lots of people have figured that the worst possible thing that could happen is to have world government, unless it is divided regionally with counterbalances to keep elbow room, which is desperately necessary in human life. So if I talk favorably about world government in passing, it was only in passing. I can make quite a speech on the other side if you would ask me to. Schmidt?
I'd like to talk to you about your gentleman who insisted that people that disagree with your point of view and who insist on the right of answering the conscience and not even hear from.
Well, it's your privilege. That was the understanding.
Secondly, when I hear you saying on that you're identifying your particular point of view with what biblically and especially we should believe, well, I think another thing we have to express is that there is room here to people
to
look at the
standard
here at all, and
therefore,
why
don't
you
I'm not here. Not yet. No, remember, I said that. I don't have any school answers. You're going to have to weigh this yourself and come up with your own conclusions.
Because I think our national standards are one of the things rather than a cry of the in terms of 1954 and the Geneva Court, I think a couple of stipulations there. One of them was that we were the holder to allow re-elections within 18 months. And my understanding of that situation was that we didn't allow the election because we were afraid that Ho Chi Minh was a recognized political leader and didn't want him to be.
Yeah, because I expected this question. It comes up all the time. And I'm glad to have the opportunity to fill in some of the details. This was our agreement at Geneva. It was also part of the Geneva agreement that North Vietnam would pull out of South Vietnam all its military cadres and troops. When we saw that North Vietnam was not doing this, then we said to ourselves, and that's General Eisenhower said, if they are not going to abide by their agreement, which alone makes it possible to have a free election, then we can't possibly throw the South Vietnamese into that kind of trap. Now, while we're about this, let me just correct one other thing. This floats around all the time, that General Eisenhower, or President Eisenhower, said the South Vietnamese would vote 80% for Ho Chi Minh. But you know, that's not what he said. He said, if the choice were between Ho Chi Minh and Bao Dai, the emperor, then probably there would be 80%. But Bao Dai was followed by Diem, who for 3 years followed a very enlightened policy and would have succeeded to win over South Vietnam, except that North Vietnam wasn't about to stand for that. So they sent in troops and developed their cadres down south. And by that time, 2 years had passed, and we didn't think it was worth the risk of throwing the South Vietnamese away, because we knew the thing would be rigged. Now, we have consistently, and please let me emphasize this, We have consistently said we are for elections under UN supervision. Diem, as a matter of fact, made that proposition to Ho Chi Minh once. And guess what? There's one thing a communist state cannot afford, and that's fresh air, supervision, where things can be checked out. So he declined it. That's also part of the picture. Mr. Scheiber.
As a theologian, could you...
Speak loudly.
As a theologian, could you tell us whether you consider the just war secular confession to be doctrine?
No, I do not. I called it a concept. You at least have to confront it when you read the confessions. They make the point that when David engaged in wars against the Philistines, he was doing a great thing. A good thing. Now you've at least got that to work with. No, you can't make a doctrine out of just war. What I was trying to say is, it's in our Lutheran tradition, and you can't make up your mind without at least having thought about it and considered the question. I thought you were going to ask the other question. You think a just war concept is still a viable notion today? Now that can be debated, but I because of the presence of nuclear war weapons. But I always keep saying, well, but we're not using nuclear weapons. This is ordinary conventional warfare, and the same principles apply that applied in any other time in history. Reader? I can only say I've dealt with some of the wounded. I was at Clark Air Base, and I discovered exactly what Mike Wallace discovered on TV the other night. Remember when he was interviewing the wounded at Fitzsimmons? He couldn't find a man who was really bitter about being wounded, except for one farmer boy from Nebraska. He tried his hardest to get a big, husky football player who had lost two legs to say that he was bitter. But he wouldn't, because he said there was a job to do, I did it. There are many people who re-up, who re-enlist in Vietnam because they have found that the people want us to be there. You know, this is a very strange thing, how some things don't get through. I read the history of the 7th Air Force last summer in July, because it is my job to write the history of the Air Force. And it is fantastic what the chaplains of the 7th Air Force have done in civic action, supporting the Protestant and Catholic religions in South Vietnam, building churches, orphanages. But where have you ever heard one syllable about this on our radio and TVs? You haven't. I haven't. And I think that says something, which I don't want to say in that many words. You might get away with it.
Mr. Kringle, you're next, and then Body. Yes, sir. Swingle. Give me a B.
But Luther.
No, his name is Swingle Luther.
By their choice.
That generation, I know.
By their choice.
I think we build a wall around our country instead of around the Russian country, building a wall around Berlin. We are setting a wall of defense about us, about the United States.
But you know, we don't have to have policemen and dogs and tanks and searchlights and landmines to keep people in. If they want to leave, they can go. You can't do that in East Germany. That's the difference.
Well, what you're saying, though, is right to kill, I think. I think that's what I'm saying. Now, I understand you saying this, you're saying this because you're a soldier.
No.
I mean, you are a general, you're a soldier, you stand for killing, you stand for war.
No. That's the one thing I don't stand
for. Well, you might have that, didn't you?
No.
You say it's right to kill? You say it's right to go to
war? No. I didn't say this. My thesis was very simple, that sometimes war is less evil than some other course of action. That's what I was saying. No, I can't argue with you.
I've been through a lot of stories on it. It's not very good.
Should we have let the Nazis just go and conquer the world? That was the choice.
Well,
that was the choice. And they almost made it.
I think we are not only dividing a war anymore, it's a refusion, a police section, a declared war.
Yeah, well, I was just using the term conveniently. Yeah, ich kann da nicht viel sagen. Wenn ihr Gewissen da ist und was macht man da? I agree. I have no quarrel with that point. We haven't suffered enough. That's right. I don't have any quarrel with that.
Okay. Mr. Boddy.
I have just a couple of statements. One that I'd like to respond to, another particularly response to Mr. Peters. Comment. One is that believe they have a reason for being here, and that there are many Vietnamese who appreciate their being here. But I have heard from many sources, from people who have been there, who also recognize the fact that there are many people who don't understand why they are there even less than we do. And another writing about last night from my friend in Cameron Bay, one of the very strong indications. Secondly, with regard to your comments about the atrocities of the communists in North Vietnam and other areas, I would certainly agree there have been many, and do not presume these, I probably wouldn't hear if I did. But I'd also like to bring up the fact that many Americans do not realize that American men in Vietnam fighting, a few of these men have committed the same kind of atrocities, and that we can find these atrocities to be less severe atrocities.
Yes. The difference is, you see, that when these atrocities are committed on our side, and every war brings them, they are contrary to orders and regulations. The destruction of village leaders, 53,000 of them on the part of the Viet Cong in cold blood, was done in conformance with and in obedience to specific responsible orders. That's quite a world of difference, ethnically speaking, I would think, between those two. The trooper in Cameron Bay, you say, well, you always have to remember one thing about soldiers. There are two places they lie, where they have been and where they're going. And they never like where they are. And they can think up all kinds of things and reasons for not wanting to be where they are. Now, I don't know. I didn't read the letter. I don't know.
I don't think that's really correct interpretation of the way I read it.
No. That I deny very specifically that that's prevalent. That is not prevalent among the troops.
I would disagree with that.
Well, I just... Let me just say that's not a correct statement. That is not true.
Well, that is a disagreement.
But you see, we've got all kinds of studies on this.
With regard to your comment about the intentional country enforced atrocities of the North Vietnam, and on this matter, does this not then have something to say about our selective service system, or just how selected it is if we allow some Americans to go over there who probably should not be in the Army or Air Force? Does this have something to say about just how selective our system is?
I believe our next class begins at 12:25, does it not? And I think you'll have to, maybe Bonnie, and you can get settled that.
No, the answer to that isn't difficult. Nobody claims that the selective service is fully just, and maybe there are troops who shouldn't be in South Vietnam. Who can deny that? But when you're dealing with 11 million men, as we have over the years, a few exceptions to the general rule, I think are pretty good exhibit for the fact that it works reasonably well, and I'm not one to argue the selective service one way or another.
There are two speakers yet that we wanted to hear, but I'm sorry we'll have to cut it at this time. I want to thank you men for being here in this important matter, and remember that this matter and other and all the circumstances are a matter of theology, matter of conscience, sometimes judgment. And let us not now get any ideas about a man who made this statement or that statement and then cease talking to each other on any individual. But let's all talk about this because it's complex. It takes a long time. Let's work on the concept of what's a just war and some of the other major items that came out of here. So, Dr. Charlemagne, thank you very much for coming here and raising these issues in question.